what the local news put out there.
An individual with a knife coming at the officer.
That is not the story. This boy been shot, and it's a lot of bullet holes in him.
I'm just going.
All right, we are going to talk about 16 Shots. It's a Showtime documentary that I believe dropped last Friday. Am I correct?
Yes, it first aired last Friday.
Okay.
Now it's streaming.
And I cannot wait to see it. Jamie Calvin is with us. You're a journalist. You're one of the producers of 16 Shots. Let's just go right to the beginning. How did this documentary happen?
So I did another small project with Rick Rowley, the director, at a time when the Laquan McDonald story was, you know, a huge focus in the city. And I had published the first article in February of 2015, based on the autopsy.
That's
and
so long ago. You
it's
forget
so long
that.
Ago. Yeah, I mean, and the incident itself was October 20th, 2014, and really the a key step in the process. Think about how many incidents, how many times we've read stories like this in the paper, and the police narrative: officer shot in self-defense. And kind of turned the page.
You accept it and move on.
And so these are really, really hard stories to report. And I got a call, was contacted through a colleague maybe a week after the incident by somebody in law enforcement who said, you know, that police-involved shooting that was reported last week wasn't at all what was reported in the paper. It was horrific. There's dash cam video. And he was also able to provide, you know, enough, not an exact address, but enough information that I was able to track down civilian witnesses. So, you know, if it were not for that, you think about what this whole episode has meant in the city. It's completely transformed the city, transformed our civic life. Unimaginable we would have had the mayoral election we just had absent this. I mean, this is the Laquan McDonald era.
Right.
But if it wasn't for a single individual in law enforcement, we probably wouldn't know the name Laquan McDonald.
So then when you got that information, what did you do then?
So I, you know, so I, actually the first thing I did is kind of, I've often done that with this kind of reporting. I actually went to the site at 41st and Pulaski on the southwest side, which is kind of this amazing, and at night, you know, and the incident occurred sort of between 9:30 and 10 at night. It's simultaneously this place, Chicago, the city of broad shoulders, you know, there are truck yards and the expressway, the Eisenhower. But it also feels as desolate as the far side of the moon.
Yeah.
You know, you can see the skyline in the distance, but it's an industrial area. It clears out at night. And really, so the, you know, the question was, what happened here? And the next steps were to find the civilian witnesses who really are heroes in this.
Yeah.
There's a gentleman, Jose Torres, and his son Xavier, who were driving on Pulaski, blocked by the police action that was taking place, and had an unobstructed view of the shooting. And when I found Jose and appeared at his doorstep, he, you know, the most decent, hospitable man, he was horrified to have me show up. How did I know?
Yeah.
He was afraid of police retaliation. He was looking over my shoulder to see if, you know, there was a SWAT team behind me. And but he couldn't help, such a decent guy, he couldn't help but tell me what he had seen.
Did it match what we saw?
And so for me, that was a, there were two key moments long before the video came out. That was one, to have found a completely credible civilian witness who was able to describe precisely what we ultimately, you know, a year later saw in the video.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once I had found Jose, I was all in on the story. I knew something had really happened, because you get tips and sometimes they don't, you know, you drill a dry hole. And the next step was to get the autopsy report. The autopsy was performed the morning after the shooting, so the 21st, 8:30 a.m. But it takes, you know, a couple of months for an autopsy to be finalized and to be subject to a document, you know, Freedom of Information Act request.
So that's available for public consumption, an autopsy report, maybe a dash cam. Are those things allowable?
Well, that's what we ended up fighting over. Autopsy reports, once they're concluded, are public information.
They are.
And before it was finalized, I went to President Toni Preckwinkle.
Yeah.
I was a source, and I've known her for many years. And I asked her if she could find out the sort of top line content of the autopsy. And we tell this story in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And we are neighbors on the south side. And I went out for a run in Washington Park. And it's probably early January, around New Year's, dark, snowing. And President Preckwinkle pulled up in her vehicle mm-hmm. and sort of beckoned me to get into the car. I got in the car, and I don't even think we exchanged hellos. She said 16 shots. Front and back.
Really?
And that was the first time I heard any, you know, think about that phrase, 16 shots. It's been almost like a musical composition
yeah.
for this era. You know,
yeah.
young activists shouting it in the street.
Yeah.
It's the title of our film. It was the title of my original article. But that's when I first heard it. And then about a week later, I was able to get my hands on the document itself. And again, as I say in the film, autopsies are amazing documents. So it's kind of a narrative of what happened.
Because
the
of the complexity of the detail, is that what it's you're saying?
You know, right. So I spent days just poring over the autopsy
yeah.
and figuring out how to report it.
Yeah.
I can't remember how many pages it is, but it's, you know, it's a thick document, and every wound gets a full description.
Yeah.
Where the bullet entered, what bone, tissue, organ it passed through, mm. where it exited. And for me, actually poring over the autopsy, imagining what happened on the basis of the autopsy, and then trying to, you know, as I did in an article that appeared in Slate February 10th, 2015, to render it for other readers, that was more impactful for me than the seeing the video, because the video was kind of, when it finally came out, for all of its huge impact, for me it was kind of corroboration of things
yeah.
that I had other means of knowing. And I remember just my hands trembling when I finished that article. It was just so so appalling, and the knowledge, and this is what I think made this such an explosive episode, that the police department in the city had all of this information, including the video, from the first moments. While the boy is bleeding out on the ground, they have witnesses, both police and civilian. They know the condition of the body, and they put out what we now know to be a utterly false narrative. You know, if people, I'm sure, remember this. The story was from a police union spokesperson on the scene, and then a press release that went out that night within hours of the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Aggressive, agitated young man with a knife lunges at police officer. Police officer has no choice but to shoot him in self-defense, and the implication was one shot to the chest, and he dies sometime later.
Did anyone question that when that came out? Because I just went, oh, that's just too bad. That's
yeah,
tragic.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, for me, I actually remember the incident, and I remember discussing it with colleagues. This is, you know, I report on police abuse issues, and this is something, just on the face of it, seemed kind of implausible that, and this is a really important thing to remember. So initially, a call went out from dispatch. Somebody's with a knife is trying to break into trucks in a truck yard. And actually, the police response, until Officer Jason Van Dyke, some minutes into this unfolding action, arrived, the police response was what we would want.
Yeah.
So the two officers, Gaffney and McGilligott, came to the scene. They see this kid. He's kind of wandering around. He's got a knife, but he's kind of in a bit of a daze, disassociated. And instead of ratcheting up, they saw there's nobody around. He's not threatening anybody. They were patient. I mean, if that were my son, or if I lived in that neighborhood and somebody's wandering, this is what I would want the police to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we have footage in the film. There's another video, and it's from external surveillance cameras on the Greater Chicago Food Depository that's there. And you can see the prelude. The first chapter of this is Laquan McDonald's walking purposefully down the street. Officer McGilligott is out of the squad car and maybe 4 or 5 paces behind him with a flashlight. And Gaffney is driving the police car and, you know, a couple of car lengths. And they're kind of accompanying the kid. neither the officers nor the boy know that they're accompanying him to his death.
Yeah.
But, you know, the police response was completely appropriate. And so to your point about first reading the story, I do remember sort of just having it nag on me that in the reporting, they say that the responding officers called for a taser.
Yeah.
They didn't call for massive backup. They called for a taser. They didn't have a taser. And we now know from their testimony that they thought that that was sort of the outer limits of force they might need, and they didn't have a taser in their vehicle. So how you go from that to a dead child on the street was I that. But again, you know, I get a lot of credit for breaking the story, but I were it not for the nudge of a whistleblower, I would have turned the page.
Jamie Calvin is our guest, freelance journalist, one of the producers of 16 Shots, which can be seen right now on Showtime. It's the story of Laquan McDonald and the shooting. We'll pick this up in just a moment. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
You're broken down and tired.
We're talking with Jamie Calvin, and I am so sad we're going to run out of time because Bill and I have a million questions for you. You're a freelance journalist, one of the producers of 16 Shots, which you can see now on Showtime. Officer Jason Van Dyke, Laquan McDonald, we were talking about this whole situation. What would have happened, I wonder, if Officer Van Dyke would have just come right out and said, I can't tell you anything other than I panicked, I overreacted, I am so sorry. How would that, and would that have changed anything?
I think that would have changed a great deal. You know, I sat through the trial, the month-long trial, and nothing I saw in the trial, including Officer Van Dyke's testimony, very dramatic towards the end of the trial, suggested any plausible explanation except that he had a kind of...
Was in fear for his life.
Well, he had a psychological episode. He lost it. There were 9 other officers there, you know, and the criteria for the use of deadly force is, was there a reasonable... you know, fear of, and 9 other officers did not find it necessary to shoot. He wasn't uniquely positioned relative to the young man. There were other officers who had kind of closer encounters. The thing was completely under control. They had basically corralled Laquan McDonald. He had nowhere to go. He was shying away, as we all know from the video, mm-hmm. from the officers. There was nothing aggressive about him. I mean, he had a, you know, he had a 3-inch knife in his hand. But we also know, and I think it's probably the case that even under the circumstances, if Van Dyke had shot once or twice,
mm-hmm.
and that this case wouldn't have evolved the way it did. Most of the shots were fired when the boy is writhing in pain on the ground in fetal position. We've all seen that. So, I've tried to imagine what it would have been like for the city if instead of what we've had, which has been a full force argument from the police union and from the defense, that what we saw in the video, I mean, I saw an execution of a child, was good police work, was justified, was within policy, was legal. That has been so polarizing for the city. Whereas, you know, if the defense had been, my client had a psychotic break, this is an utterly regrettable thing. You know, you could also have, they could also have marshaled a defense that really raised some issues about the failures of the police department to
right.
provide officer wellness, you know,
yeah.
mental health
yep,
resources,
things like
to
that.
Intervene appropriately. Van Dyke had a problematic record that nothing in his record predicted this terrible event, but it certainly was a basis for somebody to intervene and say, you know, what's going on with this guy?
Was it ever determined, Jamie, if either that night or in the next few nights, in a short span of time, the police officers got together and came up with a different story?
Yeah, so that's really the story we tell in the film. And, I mean, we know that the officers on the scene, including Van Dyke, went back to a nearby police station, and along with union representatives and detectives, were all in a kind of bullpen together, looking at the video, talking. You know, there was the second trial, the conspiracy trial,
yeah.
in which several of those officers were acquitted. I think it was a travesty,
yeah.
given the evidence. I think part of what we still have to better understand if we're really going to make the kind of changes that the city aspires to make is, I think I've written a lot about the so-called code of silence, you know, which is really a matter of narrative control. It's less a matter of silence than of enforcing a narrative. And, you know, I think one of the paradoxes of the second trial, where they charged conspiracy to cover up the murder, is when a culture is that pervasive,
yeah,
you don't need to conspire. Everybody just leans in. You know, nobody had to conspire for officers on the scene where the boy is bleeding out on the ground to shoo away witnesses, civilian witnesses. Jose Torres and others told me that they were told, get out of here. Nobody interviewed them. They just witnessed a homicide. Nobody took contact information. That wasn't a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the officers who, as many of your listeners will know, officers soon after the incident went into a nearby Burger King and sort of commandeered the surveillance equipment.
Right.
That, you know, so it's just the way it happens, you know, and so the senior folks who, there's always, this is called the street chief, there's always a senior officer who on any 24-hour basis is sort of the on-duty incident commander, mm-hmm. who gets a call if there's something, you know, of this nature. When that person comes to the scene, I'm quite sure, based on my reporting, that they're not coming to find out what happened, to investigate what happened. They're coming to figure out how to justify what happened, which is just a very different mindset.
But Chicago's not unique in that, right?
Chicago's
that goes on everywhere.
Chicago's not unique. And, I mean, Chicago's got its own really dramatic history,
sure.
you know, over the last 50 years with respect to these issues. And I think, you know, I think it's actually even perceptual. I mean, if you're, and think about, you know, the pedophile crisis in the church.
Yeah.
This, I mean, I think there are, I've really tried to understand this with some sympathy for officers. First, for the line officers, the rank and file, when you have to risk everything mm-hmm. to break ranks. But for the higher ups as well, you know, for the good of the department. That's mm-hmm. you just have a narrative in your head. This is the department can't stand another scandal.
No.
Ferguson, you know, at the time of the Laquan McDonald shooting, Ferguson was in complete turmoil. And so that shapes perception for people. I mean, within 24 hours of the incident, in Gary McCarthy's office, the then superintendent, he and police brass reviewed the, you know, the report from the street chief, so-called, on the incident, and looked at the video and found it a justified shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez. What do you say to the officers that might be listening right now or who have seen 16 shots on Showtime? What do you say to them? Do they feel betrayed by you? What do you want to say
to
them?
I have, it's interesting. I have complicated, not to spout the cliches everybody always spouts about the police. I have great regard. Somebody once said to me, the deputy commissioner of police in New York, former deputy commissioner, said, and I've always sort of tried to hold on to this, in a democracy, there's nothing as good as a good police officer, and there's nothing as bad as a bad police officer. And really, the work that people like me are engaged in, and in my case, it's, you know, as a reporter, is really directed towards enabling the good police officers to do their jobs
sure.
without being impeded and seen by the public in light of the bad officers. And, you know, often when there are incidents like this, the defense of police and military and paramilitary is to say, well, it's a few bad apples. And there's, you know, that's not quite right, but it's not quite wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, a relatively small number of corrupt or violent or racist officers can do immense damage if they operate with impunity, if they know that, and the public knows that they're not going to be identified, disciplined.
Yeah. Yeah. 16 shots. Please see it on Showtime. It's available now. Jamie Calvin, journalist and one of the producers, 16 shots. We'd love to talk to you again sometime. We have so many more questions we couldn't even get to.
I would welcome the opportunity.
Thanks, Jamie. Greatly appreciated. We'll take a quick break, get you some news, and then more show. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.